I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to discuss water, the world, and reinventing charity in an increasingly complex world. We're going to explore ways that we as individuals and as communities can meet common challenges. My guests are Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water, and Rich Klopp, CEO of Water for Good. Please join this important conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, and you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are going to be talking today about water, the world, ways that that we can meet needs that are acute. If you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Scott Harrison, who is founder of Charity Water, and Rich Klopp, who is CEO of Water for Good. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you
for having us.
It's good to have you both here. So, Scott, let's talk first. I want to give people sort of thumbnails of your organizations and what they do. I'll start with you, Scott. Talk about what Charity for Water is.
Sure. So the organization's 11 years old, and I started after a decade as a nightclub promoter in New York City. And made a real mess of my life, I guess you could say, after 10 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a relatively abrupt career shift.
Yeah, yeah. And I had this moment where I'd become the worst person I knew and needed a change, and wound up selling everything I owned to live in Liberia, post-war Liberia, on a humanitarian mission. And it was really there that I saw people drinking dirty water for the first time in my life. And I'd been selling $10 bottles of water at nightclubs to people who wouldn't even open them. They would just order them on their table. And, you know, I watched children die of diarrhea. I watched women walk hours every single day. And over a two-year period, just became moved by the need that was out there and wanted to try to do something about it. So came back and started the organization.
Rich, Water for Good.
Yeah, Water for Good, an Indiana nonprofit, actually. Started in 2004 by a man named Jim Hawking, who grew up in the Central African Republic. So we work only in one African country, and we're there with the goal of ending the water crisis in that country. We've done about 1,600 water projects, wells, and then rehabilitation of wells that, you know, somebody had put in and then never repaired since 2004. So actually, I think it was yesterday, maybe today, we celebrated our 14th year.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this larger problem here. And we have done shows on water before, and there's always this reaction when we do the show from at least a few members of the audience. You know, how can there be a water problem? You know, this planet is overwhelmingly made out of water. You know, how does this occur in this age? I'll start with you on that, Rich. Let's talk about what the problem is and what the scope of it is.
Yeah, it's you know, multifaceted problem. It's like an onion. It depends on how deep you want to go. There are political problems in a lot of developing countries where local governments just don't have the infrastructure required to provide clean, safe water to their populations. International NGOs, UN agencies, and just nonprofits from a bunch of different countries have, over the last roughly 30 years, responded to try to build capacity with those governments to, you know, a greater or lesser degree of success. And you have, you know, places that are just so incredibly remote. For example, Central African Republic, a lot of other countries where Charity Water works as well. Mm-hmm. The expense is high to get that water water infrastructure in place. In countries like the U.S., you know, it took us, what, a couple hundred years to get to this point. And that's one of the, you know, that's some of the issues that you face or some of the reasons why the water crisis exists. Right now it's estimated that about 850 million people in the world don't have access to clean water.
So basically about 2.5 times the size of the United States.
Yeah.
Right? In population of the United States. Scott, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I've been able to travel to 68 or 69 countries now, so I've seen, you know, the water crisis up close over the last 10 years. And, you know, 52% of all the disease throughout the developing world, or what some people would call the third world, is caused by a lack of clean water and lack of access to sanitation. So just imagine that half of the sick people in the world don't need to be sick. They just had clean water to drink. And, you know, what's made a big impression on me over time is, you know, we'll travel into these remote areas, whether it's Rwanda, whether it's Ethiopia, whether it's the CAR, and you're watching children drink brown, viscous water. I mean, it looks like chocolate milk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's unthinkable to us. And we wouldn't let our dogs drink this water. And then we hear from the women that they're actually walking up to 8 hours every day to get that water. You know, so the thought of, you know, a woman getting up at 4 a.m. throwing an empty jerry can, kind of a fuel can that we would see on her back, walking 3 hours out, filling up this fuel can, and then schlepping 40 pounds of dirty water back that could kill her children any mm-hmm. single day. And I lived in a village, Rich and I were talking about this at dinner last night. I lived in a village in Ethiopia where a 13-year-old girl was doing this daily walk every day, 8 hours. And at the end of one of her walks, she came back into the village and she slipped and fell. And she broke her clay pot that she'd been carrying and she hung herself from a tree. So she took the rope and tied it around her neck and climbed a tree and jumped. And the elders found this 13-year-old girl's body swinging from a tree in this village. She just didn't want to go back for water one more time. So it's a really, you know, it's a human crisis. There are, you know, names and faces and people that are kind of trapped in the water crisis. It's really not about statistics and these kind of mind-numbing, you know, the numbers that come at us.
How do we go about, and I'll make it specific, how does Charity Water go about then trying to meet this crisis?
So we fund now 11 different water solutions. So we've always taken a solution agnostic approach, sometimes digging wells, sometimes drilling wells, like in the Central African Republic with Water for Good, mm-hmm. Building rainwater harvesting systems. We've done huge, you know, $100,000 to $500,000 gravity-fed systems. Now, for instance, in Nepal, we can't drill wells in the top of mountains, so we can protect mountain springs and run them to different distribution points in the villages. So a lot of things work and a lot of different solutions. There are a lot of different solutions. We have focused on rural only. So about 80% of the people worldwide living without clean water are living in the remote rural areas. Less than 20% are living in urban environments. And that's where we're typically seeing the governments spend their money. You know, they're going where the voters are. They're in the cities and the towns, and it's really the rural people that are left behind.
And with these 11 projects, how many people do you estimate that you're serving?
So we've now funded about 25,000 projects across 24 countries for 8.2 million people. So about 1% of the problem. So, you know, a lot more to do. We're helping about 1 million people get clean water every year. So mm-hmm. about 3,000 people every day, or, you know, one person every 30 seconds. But we need to go faster and we need to help more people.
Rich. Same question. How is Water for Good approaching this problem? What solutions?
So we do borehole drilling and then rehabilitation of wells and pump infrastructure. And then our real core activity is maintenance and repair. So one of the problems in water in developing countries, Africa specifically, since that's the area where I work and know best, you find it all across the continent where, you know, projects went in, people spent money, they drilled wells or did spring protections or filtration systems or, you know, a lot of different technologies, and then it breaks and nobody's there to fix it. So one of the things that we do in Central African Republic is do startup of locally owned and operated businesses is a way to make the projects sustainable. So right now, we have teams like today, four trucks cruising around Central African Republic, very remote country, really bad roads, repairing wells. About 1,100 pumps under maintenance in what is actually the world's poorest country.
And Rich, sometimes they're paid with goats and, you know, two eggs, right? I mean, some of these communities are so poor that they don't actually have the money for the repairs, and you guys are helping to subsidize that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's part of the partnership with Charity Water. So Charity Water funds or subsidizes part of that intervention. And then communities actually do repayment, like Scott was saying, in whatever way they can.
Scott, where do you find the money? I mean, that's not an inexpensive proposition. And you've done quite a bit. I think, it's more than $200 million, right?
300 now.
$300 million, yeah.
We find it from everyday people. More than a million donors have given. So when we started, we just believed that, you know, everyone could care about clean drinking water. I mean, you know, there are a few things today in a divisive society where everybody seems to be fighting about everything that we thought people could agree on. And clean water for human beings in need, you know, felt like something that could bring people on opposite ends of, you know, religious views or political views together. So, you know, a lot of it happens online. You know, we were the first charity to get a million Twitter followers. We were the first charity to use Instagram. We've really been able to reach out to a lot of young people and say, even if you have $30, we can give one person access to clean water. And, you know, Charity Water has a unique business model that I think has helped us scale the fundraising. From day one, we promised that 100% of all donations we would ever collect would only fund these water projects that we would then prove every water project using photos and GPS and satellite images. And then we raise all of the overhead for the organization, which is about just that part is about $13 million a year. We raise that from 130 families. Mm-hmm. So almost like an endowment, but 130, you know, families make it possible for a million donors to have a pure way of giving. To know that if they give $100 or $1,000, every single penny goes directly to the projects.
How did you arrive at that model?
Well, I had the advantage of starting the nonprofit with no nonprofit experience and, you know, 10 years of nightclub experience. So I was just talking to people. You know, I was 30 at the time, and I was talking to people, and I realized there was a huge distrust of charity by Americans. So 42% of Americans polled by USA Today said they don't trust charities. Mm-hmm. And 70% of Americans polled by NYU Stern said they believe charities waste money or badly waste money. Mm-hmm. So that was the problem I was really trying to solve, was could we bring these disenchanted people who were not giving, who didn't trust the system, who had, you know, a sad story of corruption or scandal in their back pocket as a reason for not engaging? Could we give them a completely new business model, a hyper-transparent organization? Could we track their dollars and show them the impact? For me, it was two bank accounts, just one bank account for overhead and the rest where all the public's money would go. And then because money would not be fungible, we could track those dollars and we could show a 14-year-old girl that the $11 she was able to collect wound up in Central African Republic or in Malawi or in India in a specific village and how much that project cost.
Do you remember the moment when you arrived at the, okay, it's two bank accounts and really... Because in some ways, this reverses the traditional not-for-profit model, which is you go after the, you know, the big donors mm-hmm. and the big cash gifts to drive the mission, and then it's the smaller donors who often fund the overhead.
Yeah, well, I was sleeping on a closet floor at the time, and I just felt so clear to me. And of course, as I told people this idea, they said, "Well, that's a stupid idea. You'll never be able to build a credible organization. Who would ever want to pay for your staff salaries or your office costs or your health care, you know, 401k benefits for your employees?" And I just believe that. That there would be people that would mm-hmm. that were builders that didn't need their name on a well. They didn't need their name on a building. They would selflessly give in the support of building something truly unique that could reach out to millions of not only disenchanted donors, but impact millions of people's lives.
Who were the first angels? Do you recall who? You had to sell it on some people. sell that to some people?
Well, you know, there's a long story there. We almost ran out of money and
went bankrupt.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. We're going to be coming up here on a break. I do want to hear that story though, because it is a fascinating one. Particularly, I want to hear how you averted bankruptcy. I think that would be a good one. We are talking about water and the world, the challenges that we face in getting human beings clean drinking water, particularly in some of the poorer and more remote parts of this globe. My guests are Scott Harrison. He is the founder of Charity Water, and Rich Klopp. He is the CEO of Water for Good. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about water and the world. My guests are Scott Harrison, who is founder of Charity Water, and Rich Klopp, who is CEO of Water for Good. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So right before we went to the break, we left you with a cliffhanger here. We had poor Scott bankrupt, and if I recall correctly, sleeping in a closet. Well, take us back there.
The short part of the story is that the 100% model was so powerful that we began to raise money for the water project extraordinarily quickly. We raised $2 million the first year. A year and a half in, so halfway into our second year, we had been scrapping to raise money for, three or four employees at the time. And, you know, it came in fits and starts, fives and 10 grands and 20 grands from donors. But there was no way to really sustain it. So we had a moment where there was $144 in the overhead account and $881,000 headed out for the water projects that we couldn't touch. And to make matters even more difficult for ourselves, we'd promised that we would pay back credit card fees. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we said 100%. We had to mean the real 100%. So if someone gave $100 on their American Express card, we only got 96 of that. Mm-hmm. So we were making up the difference, the 4%, and sending the intended 100 out. So at this moment, you know, the critics were right, and I was going to dissolve the organization, send the 881 grand out, and build as many wells or water projects as we could. And at that moment, a complete stranger, an internet entrepreneur, walked into the office and sat with me for 2 hours and just listened to my vision of the organization, the vision of the 100% model. And he left and he said, well, let me think about how I might be able to help. And 2 days later, he sends me an email and says, I enjoyed meeting with you. I've wired $1 million into your overhead account.
Oh, wow.
So we went from shutting the organization down to 13 months of capital, working capital. And we used that extra time to now build what's a much more sophisticated multi-year, multi-tier giving program of 135 families that joined Michael and his wife, our first big giver.
And on average, how much do they give?
They give between 60 grand a year to $1 million a year.
Okay. Okay. And does he come in still?
Michael has actually given $20 million since that moment. And I've had the pleasure of taking him and his three children and his wife to 9 different countries. In 3 weeks, we're going on a family trip to Mozambique, which will be our 10th trip together as a family. So he's really grown up with the organization. They helped build a fundraising platform that raised another $50 million and have become really good friends.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Mike, and if you want to join this conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Mike writes, do the guests today have any suggestion on how to help places such as Flint, Michigan? I'll throw that one to Rich. Or actually, Scott's pointing at it.
I'm pointing at Rich.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nobody else in the studio we can point at.
Yeah.
You know, I look like a Hoosier because I was born here, but my parents were missionaries. I grew up in Africa, so I'm the last person to be able to talk about water in the United States. Although, you know, I have noticed that this is becoming a big conversation. Probably happens due to water scarcity in California. You know, the aquifers apparently going dry. Water quality issues, like, you know, that we all found about because of the problems in Flint. So it's a global issue. I mean, water is a scarce commodity, and it needs to be protected sustainably. It's not just an African issue, that's for sure. Obviously, that's what I know more about.
And I know we're circling back to kind of an earlier question I asked. Is part of the problem here often that people just take water for granted?
Yeah.
They assume that all you have to do is walk over and turn on a tap and there it is. I'll start with Rich, but I'd like to hear Scott's thoughts on that too, because I would think that's one of the obstacles that you face in getting people to understand the crisis and the work that you have to do is getting past that complacency.
Yeah, and I think of it infrastructurally because of what I do, right?
Yeah.
So not only do you start taking it for granted when, you know, you just turn a tap and water comes out, but you take for granted the pipes, you know, underneath our cities, for example, you know, the issue in Flint. So there's a lot that goes into providing clean and safe drinking water. And, you know, I'm just thankful every day when it works because I spend a lot of time in places where it doesn't. And requires coordinated efforts between governments, you know, from federal down to the state. And this is, again, back to the problems that you find in a lot of African countries. And that's why organizations like ours are there to help work with them, build the necessary infrastructure, and then maintain it. Because no, it can go wrong in Flint.
Scott.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Reef Flint. A bunch of our supporters, you know, reached out and asked the same question, and we looked at it when it happened and just realized that we didn't add any value. I mean, we had no expertise that was relevant. It was political, hundreds of millions of dollars of infrastructure. Really needed to completely solve the problem. We wound up just recommending a bunch of local organizations that were working on kind of short-term gap solutions until, you know, the infrastructure, the politics could be worked out. But, you know, with taking water for granted, it's interesting. You know, I'm always monitoring our social media, and one of the things I see all the time is someone will reach out to Charity Water and say, "I lost water today, and I'm thinking of you." You know, like the water was turned off in my building for 3 hours today, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So it's really not until, you know, it's taken away. There was a Benjamin Franklin quote that I came across years ago that says, "When the well is dry, we know the value of water." You know, it's only at that moment when it's taken from us that we kind of think about it. And you know, I try and just put it in terms of quantity. I mean, you know, a woman in the developing world in places where, you know, Rich and I are working and traveling, you know, she is walking all day for one toilet flush, you know, and that's the water that she needs to use to cook, to drink, to wash clothes for her family. So, you know, a 3-minute shower for us, one toilet flush, this is the total amount of water that someone living in a rural context is going to be struggling to find, and the water's not even clean. So it's just so far. It's just so hard for people to imagine. Just one last thing I'd say. I speak a lot at conferences, and I remember following the CEO of a huge cancer charity once, and there were 1,000 people in the audience, and he gets out and says, "Okay, raise your hand if you've had cancer." You know, maybe a third of the hands go up. And he said, "What about a family member?" Now he's got half the audience. And then he says, "Okay, what about a friend?" 100% of the 1,000 people have their hands in the air. And then he begins his talk. You know, if I get out on stage and say, "How many of you have lost a child to trachoma, dysentery, bilharzia?" You know, "How many of you have walked 8 hours?" It's crickets. You know, no one is responding to that. So that's why, you know, it's the images, it's the videos, it's the storytelling, it's the statistics that we are trying to bring to people to say, look, this is a problem and it's a solvable problem. We can do something about it.
I think we've got a listener via Twitter who wanted to ask if you do any projects in the United States. I think we've gotten the answer.
Yeah, we don't.
To that.
We don't.
You don't. Are there, but I'll take it one step further and try to anticipate the next question that would come in along that line. Are there any circumstances in which you would consider doing projects in the United States? Or is this, you know, so far away from what we consider, you know, the crisis levels we're talking about in other places.
Yeah, I mean, we just point to a couple of the organizations that are. I mean, America officially has 100% water coverage. What's water coverage in the CAR?
About half, 50%.
Yeah, so about half. So I think we've just focused, and, you know, one of the things that we've realized is the deeper you go in a level in an area of focus, the better you actually get at it. So we just don't have any expertise when it comes to political negotiating to infrastructure, you know, at a massive scale.
We are talking about water in the world and places where clean, safe water is hard to find. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. So, I would like to just first of all thank both of the guys there representing their tremendous organizations. They're very well known, and for people who work with water every day like I do here in central Indiana, they just represent a lot of hope for people who don't have access to water. I just want to make one quick point. We work a lot in Marion County with protecting the water supplies for the people who drink. And all future increases in clean water that we will drink in Marion County will come from groundwater, which is what these guys are out looking for around the world. And our biggest challenge here is to protect that water so it doesn't become polluted, because we have hundreds of businesses over the top of our aquifer system. So their work is important. We have the same challenge here, keeping the water clean, and it's something that we are trying to make people more aware of, and so I just wanted to ask these folks to comment on the idea of the quality of water they're getting versus the quantity, and how they're going about protecting that water in some of the remote places in the world. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, John. And there, you guys are both looking at each other. So
yeah, sure. I mean, I can start. We, you know, I think we're not seeing this as an issue because of the environments, at least that the Charity Water is working in. There are not agricultural plants nearby. Mm. There are not industrial waste spewing. You know, these are rural farmers in hills. I mean, you know, the village I mentioned where that 13-year-old girl, you know, unfortunately took her life. There are 2,800 people living with no cell service, no general store, no place to buy AA batteries. We are, you know, and our local partners are much more concerned, I think, about the actual quantity of the groundwater, doing things like terracing in Ethiopia, making sure that when the rains come, you know, it's not just washing away, but they're actually replenishing those aquifers. We'll see a lot of partners that are doing hand dug wells, you know, build these giant kind of gullies around them, trying to actually make sure that when it rains, they're catching that, and it's replenishing the groundwater if it's a shallow source. And, you know, I'd say, and I'm pretty sure you guys are doing this too, but we're testing the water, you know, after we drill a well. Mm-hmm. And not all is good, right? There's places where, you know, we've got arsenic or naturally occurring fluoride. And, you know, there are times when, you know, you drill a well and the water quality is not, it's not good enough, and you have to shut it down. You cap it and you move on.
Rich.
Yeah, we do water testing. You know, I've heard somebody describe the situation, and you have to realize we work in extremely poor countries. Central African Republic right now, as I mentioned earlier, is by UN stats considered to be the poorest country on the planet. So the problems are infrastructural. I've heard somebody describe it as pre-environmental almost, meaning it's not that the, you know, ecological or environmental issues related to water are not critical for these countries, but, you know, you have people just dying because they don't have clean water to drink. So phase one is provision. Phase two then is let's make sure that the infrastructure that's put in place is sustainable while we also, you know, learn about the geology, the aquifers, water, you know, the more extended and more technical issues related to water that I think the caller is very well aware of. And, you know, bring the technologies into the country and help build capacity with the local water people to understand these, you know, to understand water and help protect it for themselves as well as the globe.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Shannon. Again, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Shannon writes, I imagine water is a critical political resource in some very dangerous places. How do you keep your people safe?
Yeah, Central African Republic. If you Google it, you'll see a lot of weaponry. The country melted down. Water for Good was born out of a war conflict in 2004, and then the country went back into civil conflict in 2013. Water for Good was one of the partners that hung with us to keep water flowing, starting then and moving forward. But I think situation in CAR is not just Central African Republic. You find the same problem in many countries. The way we handle this is we have all African staff. We don't land any expats. So we have highly trained technicians. They know when to go, when not to go. They're aware of their local context in ways that we wouldn't be, you know, if we lived in these countries. And quite frankly, we've continued to work every year since the war. It hasn't slowed us down, even though, yes, water is very political in these countries. So your caller's right.
And I would just say that, you know, they're brave as well. I mean, Rich, some of your people have been kidnapped trying to get out to reach remote Bayaka pygmy villages to provide water. And, the truck they're driving is valuable to the rebels, and they'll be kidnapped. And so they're really, you know, there's some really brave people out there who, you know, are risking their lives to help some of the most desperate people. Despite some of this conflict.
We call them water heroes.
Mm-hmm. We've gotten an email from our regular listener, Marion. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion writes, thank you for all you are doing. As you probably know, over 80% of Indiana's waterways are contaminated with E. coli. A major contributor is animal agriculture, which spends billions promoting animal-based food. Can we justify continued expansion of livestock production and American promotion of animal-based diet throughout the world when the meat and dairy industry use one-third of the fresh water? We need to address the root causes, and it seems the rich and those profiting from industrialized agriculture are wasting water while the poor suffer. 82% of starving children live in countries where food is grown to feed livestock that is eaten in Western countries. Scott or Rich, either one of you.
Not an issue we face in Central African Republic, as mentioned earlier. Yeah, yeah, just not in our area of expertise. So,
my experience, you know, working with the rural poor is that the meat would be eaten on such a rare occasion. You know, we're talking about once every few months. They might enjoy goat in a local village. You know, there are some animals around. They're typically for milk production for children. We're not seeing, I would say I'm seeing much more of a non-meat eating rural population, you know, across our portfolio. I'm not that familiar with Indiana's waterways, but it sounds like she's done her research.
Well, and I guess her larger point, I think, though, is how much of this is also a problem created by the demand and the luxury of the Western world? These developed, richer countries that exploit resources from other places. Rich, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, definitely a global problem. Central African Republic is so extremely poor. Industry is basically non-existent in a country like that. So not something that we face there, but I'm very well aware of the issue. And things happening. Decisions we make every day, right, related to whatever we purchase, you know, whatever we do, whatever we drink, affects all of us around the world. Absolutely right.
We are talking about water and the world here on No Limits today. My guests are Scott Harrison. He is the founder of Charity Water, and Rich Klopp. He is the CEO of Water for Good. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits at FYI.org. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, and you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. We're going to continue talking about water in the world and how we can meet some of the challenges facing 850 million people without water around the world. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about water and the world, particularly the parts of the world where getting clean water is difficult, at times almost impossible. Nearly 850 million people, or roughly 850 million people, are without access to clean water. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Scott Harrison. He is the founder of Charity Water, and Rich Klopp. He is CEO of Water for Good. So I want to ask, I mean, you know, Scott, you've now raised $300 million, and that's funded a lot of projects. Obviously, Water for Good has done, if I recall correctly, something like 1,600
That's right.
projects. And all told, we've got an 850 million person problem, and we've met the needs of about 1% of them. What would it take to solve the problems for all 850 million people?
I mean, I can start with that one. I mean, the good news is that when we started, there were 1.1 billion people. So this number over time has actually come down. In fact, the most recent data I saw out of the UN pegged it closer to 660 million. So this the problem is, even as global population is rising, a lot of awareness, a lot of funds, a lot of energy has gone into solving the water crisis over the last decade. So yeah, I think that's just really important for people to understand. This is not a lost cause. More people are getting access to clean water every single day. We're seeing the disease and the death dropping. The statistics are actually improving when it comes to this. So no one seems to have a number because you know it's not a problem right now where you could just simply snap your fingers and throw, you know, $1 trillion and just be done with it. You know, it's you need to create the infrastructure. There aren't even enough drilling rigs. There aren't enough teams that could build rainwater harvesting systems or biosand filters or, you know, all the different technologies. So it's kind of a little bit of the chicken and the egg. As you raise more money, you build the capacity of our partners. Just an example, in northern Ethiopia, a region called Tigray, we've now been working there for 10 years. And when we started, there were about 50 people working in the rural water supply, 50 locals. Now there's 600 people. So our local partner has 11x'd the capacity. There were a couple drilling rigs. Now there are 9 working every single day. But, you know, it's not easy to go from 9 to 900 drilling rigs. So it's kind of, you know, as we raise more awareness and energy and money, we're able to raise the capacity. You also have a reverse economy of scale. So right now, you know, you might take a $12,000 well and divide by, you know, 300 people living in that community, you've got $40 a person. But as the community sizes shrink, the cost per person actually goes up because you still have your capital, your infrastructure cost. But if there are only 200 people living there or 100 people living there, it actually gets more expensive.
So we've gotten a tweet from a listener named Matthew. And again, you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. Matthew writes, not all places in the world have an EPA. How many waterways are being destroyed in developing nations without proper oversight? And how do you prevent the short-term business interests from doing long-term harm? Rich, I'll throw that one to you first, but I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I can only talk about Central African Republic. We only work in that country. So short-term business interests in that country are mostly interested in the diamonds and gold that are getting hauled out of that country. So water isn't, you know, isn't an industry that's impacted, I think, by, you know, by the type of thing that I think, anyway, if I understand the tweet right. However, you know, there are, we're not the only organization in the country drilling wells, right? Mm-hmm. Some of them are for-profits. We're the only nonprofit. We like that approach. So again, we're a nonprofit, but we're there, what we're there to do is start locally owned and operated businesses. So that means every dollar that flows into that country then gets captured by that local business. They hire local people. And, you know, no country on the planet would develop if you can't protect those markets. So there are markets for water, but they need to be protected. In Central African Republic, the government's actually working in that direction. UNICEF is the head of the WASH cluster there, the Water Sanitation Hygiene Cluster. They're working on the same issue. We're in partnership with them. And then organizations like Charity Water that come alongside organizations like ours and fund, are the ones who, you know, together we look at this as a water ecosystem, from creating the markets to then creating the businesses that serve those markets, so that water can work just like it does in United States, for example.
Scott, that question's really about, you know, after you build it, how do you make sure someone else doesn't take it hostage?
That's a great question. I mean, I've heard that. I would say that would be in the list of top three questions that we'd be asked over, you know, the last decade. And I think it surprises people. You know, sometimes it gets asked as, well, what about the warlords? You know, you build the well. Don't the warlords then come in and terrorize the people, or take it over, or lock it up? We really haven't seen that. I mean, with rare exception now, across, you know, 24 countries and now 11 years of experience, you know, the value, and you could actually say unfortunately, is not high enough for some of these people. If you tried to charge a rural community in the CAR for water, they would go back to the swamp. They wouldn't have the money to pay. There's just no market to oppress the rural poor. You know, they would go back to walking 5 or 6 hours a day because they wouldn't have the money to support that. Mm-hmm. So I think we really frame it in the positive. What we do is we charge for water. So we and our local partners go in and set up water committees, equal number of men and women. So typically it's 6 to 8 people on a water committee. They all then share a passbook that requires the 6 or 8 signatures, and they charge everyone using the well, if that's the water point, a set amount every month. It might be 25 cents a month. It might be 50 cents a month. That money then goes into the corpus. So when maintenance is needed, and all wells will break at some point. So think of it like a car. I had a car with 285,000 miles on it as a kid, but it was in the shop a lot, right? So all, you know, a well could be good. We have wells that we've seen that are 35 years old that are still pumping, but the actual the pump needed maintenance several times over that. So, yeah, we're really involved in how is it going to work? How is it going to be maintained? Who's paying for it? Where's the supply chain for parts, for mechanics? And you know, Water for Good has one of the most innovative mechanics programs out there. Their Central Africans are actually running around with iPads and GPS devices, and it's a pretty sophisticated, highly technological program.
We are talking about water and how we get it to people who need it the most. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Tafrica has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Tafrica, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I am talking to my daughters pretty regularly about the need to just not waste water, and just how there's so many people around the world that don't have access to clean water. And we would like to give to the efforts that we're hearing about financially, but in addition to that, what other things can I do to help them engage in being part of the solution to the problem?
How old are your daughters?
They're 8, 4, and 2.
8, 4, and 2. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. 3 daughters. Mm-hmm. You have your hands full.
Absolutely.
You know, we've loved engaging kids, and one of the ways we do that is by kids will donate their birthday. And instead of accepting gifts or having a birthday party, the child will go around and ask family and grandparents and friends for their age in dollars. So your 8-year-old might ask for $8 donations to a campaign, and then Charity Water System tracks those donations through so she could actually see where they went. So that's just a really fun way for kids to get involved. They kind of get that And there's also some content that we have at our website. If you just go to charitywater.org/journey, we made content for kids to really explain to them about the water crisis, you know, what it might look like for, you know, a 10-year-old girl not to have water. So it's just some fun content you might watch with your daughters and be able to explain it to them.
Great. Thank you so much.
We've gotten a couple of tweets. Thank you very much for the call, Tafrica.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Along that line, people asking, you know, how they can get involved, how they can contribute. So I would be remiss if I didn't give each of you a chance to give the URLs and ways that people can either plug in by making a financial contribution or seeing if there are some opportunities to volunteer. I'll start with you, Rich.
Yeah, waterforgood.org. And, you know, something that kids enjoy a lot is getting a jug of water, like the ones you see in the pictures. Actually, it's the Charity Water logo. And filling it up with water and just doing a walk, seeing what that feels like. Very young girls put those jugs on their heads and carry them for long distances. So experiencing what, you know, kids their age would experience is another really interesting thing that you can do with kids.
For us, it's probably this new giving community that we launched on our 10th anniversary called The Spring. And it's a community now of people from 94 countries who give monthly, whatever they can. Some people giving $30 a month, which is enough for one person to get clean water every month. We've got, you know, college kids giving 10 bucks a month, and we have people that are giving 100 or 200. I just saw a tweet yesterday that someone canceled HBO to give the $15 a month and join the community. So that's just charitywater.org/thespring. And it's an amazing way to contribute. And then we report back to that community on their impact.
We have gotten a couple of tweets. One from a listener named Leah or Lee. And again, if you want to join the conversation by Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. She writes, super inspiring. I'd love to engage schools I work with. What can schools do in regard to this? I'll start with Rich on that, but I want to hear Scott's thoughts as well.
Yeah, the water walk I was describing works really good with schools. We have classrooms around Indiana that support our work. So, again, go to the website, waterforgood.org, and just contact us, and we can actually connect you with schools that have done fundraisers for us. We have a great partner in Warsaw, Indiana named Mudlove. They're a pottery shop, and they do fundraisers. They make products so that classrooms can raise money with it, and then part of the proceeds goes to water in Central African Republic. So get in touch with us that way.
Yeah, similarly, we have a Water for Schools program, and, you know, schools around the world have raised millions of dollars, some through, you know, through these staging these huge water walks and fundraising campaigns. And there are schools that shut down the water in the school for the whole day and really commit and show their students what it would be like to have no water fountains, no toilets that flush. It's interesting.
Yeah, that would probably be a crisis by about the fourth period, I would guess. So, we're talking about water and the world here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Niksh has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Niksh, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you. Wonderful, wonderful show. I grew up in India for 20 years, and for the last 30 years I've lived in Indiana. And every year I go, I find, honestly, the root cause of almost every issue we are dealing with, including water or disease or whatever have you, is just overpopulation and undereducation. If there was a way to address those things, many of the other things associated with that would, if not completely take care of them, would ease the pressure a lot, whether it's malaria or it's whatever other issue. Are there any efforts made towards addressing some of those issues?
Thanks very much for the call, Niksh. Scott.
Yeah, I can take that one. One of the things that I think surprises people is that, you know, when you're able to provide water, health, you know, certainly improved education, population size decreases. And, you know, Bill Gates has done a really good job in his annual letter of just continuing to come back to hit this point home. So the richest countries have the fewest children. And there's actually data out there now that links the provision of clean water to a reduced family size, reduced population. I think the most cynical I've heard that posed is like, well, why are you giving them clean water so they're going to have more kids? I'll be asked that, 10 or 15 times a year. And it's actually, well, when people get clean water and they're healthier, they have less kids and they're able to provide for those children in a greater way. We've done a lot at school, so we're really passionate about bringing clean water and sanitation to schools. So not only are schools fundraising for charity water, but we're out there bringing clean water and toilets to improve the education at those schools. I mean, imagine sending your 13-year-old girl to a school with no toilet. Imagine sending her to a school with no water. How good could that education be? So about a third of the world's schools lack clean water and toilets. So we've been really focusing some efforts there.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Greg on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Greg writes, can guests address the future of water as a commodity? Rich.
That's a broad...
that's a broad question.
Broad question. But, when I think about it in the context of Central African Republic, we very much think about it as a commodity, and we think about it as a, when we put a well in a community, put a pump on it, we think of it as a water utility. People in Central African Republic have that what they do is they pay for fees for that water, whether we're there or not. They view it as a commodity. Whether they go get it from a dirty source, haul it back up, and are paid for that activity, or send their kids down to get it, or their wives, and then you have lost time, which can be calculated as well. So, yeah, water is a commodity even in extremely poor contexts. In fact, it's a commodity that even matters more, I think, in these resource-scarce places where we work.
We've got a tweet from a listener named Lisa. She writes, I am an Indy resident fortunate to work in anti-poverty advocacy for 10 years. Water issues are integral to everything across all sectors. Thanks for what you do. It's probably the reason you guys are doing this, right, Scott?
We hear in these villages, water is life all the time. Water is life. Water is life in a bunch of different languages and, from young and old.
Okay, we've gotten a couple more messages asking for ways that people can plug in if they do want to help. So I'm going to give you a chance before we sign off here to give you URLs one more time.
Rich. Yeah, waterforgood.org, and we're there to do full coverage by 2030 in that country. Water for every man, woman, and child. So we'd love to have you join us.
And we're at charitywater.org.
I'd like to thank both of my guests, Scott Harrison and Rich Klopp, for what's been an illuminating conversation about water. I'd like to thank our listeners, as usual, for some great questions and comments. We will be back next week on Tuesday in anticipation of the school walkout. We're going to be talking about guns in America again. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.